Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He says the stock markets were in ripe territory to correct, and the Iran war may be the push for that correction. He checks out crude, gold, silver, copper, Bitcoin, and uranium. Veteran trader Victor Adair checks in from Vancouver Island to give us his take on how the markets will react to the U.S.-Iran war and his take on energy, currencies, gold, and how the crush facing the private credit market could affect everything. The Aiden sisters, Marianne and Pamela, join us from Costa Rica to give us their views on the Middle East conflict and how it's affecting the energy markets. They believe gold and silver, after a brief pause, have a lot of room to climb higher. They also have a special offer for our listeners if you mention this interview. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Well, another interesting week, Jim.
Yes, that Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times.
Yeah, and if it's a little quiet, then let's have a headline, and then that will drive the markets around. You know, this has been a, you know, we've been in a secular bull market either since, you know, 1974 or 2009. You know, take your guess on which one. But the credit market started to present problems back in October, November. We published a number of pages there indicating that, you know, the market was tired. And as it was, the S&P and the NASDAQ started to roll over at that point. Minor indices that we saw with the Russell 2000 and some of the others managed to put in new highs, but really, this was a market that was really, really getting tired. And so here we are, regardless of the news events. This has been a market that was ready for a correction, and you know, here we go. We've had this big move as far as these broad markets are concerned, and clearly, I think there's more room to go here. The S&P was just shy 6,900 to 2,000 at the top end. We're at 6,300 right now, and clearly the support levels aren't until you get down, I would say, into the 5,200 level for the S&P and maybe lower than that. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised that you get a pretty decent bounce here pretty soon, but the easiest move is to the downside. So, you know, there are few places to go and hide. The energies have been one. They've been very, very persistent. And if we take a look at the XLE or the XEG, so those are the oil-related stocks, they are up significantly. We're talking about 40% this year on those. Even though the oil market's up about 80%, the stocks are participating pretty darn well with all that's going on right now.
How would you describe what's going on with crude right now?
Well, I mean, that has been a very volatile market, to say the least. We had that first run, that spike up to 120, but that didn't hold. But the pullback has been very, very resilient. The low was at 85 on the correction. Now we've been up to 100 a couple of times, and we've closed off the week right at 100. The bias here is still the upside. Who knows when peace talks will come to fruition. But for now, 100 is a pretty important price level to be looking at. And I wouldn't be surprised that there's still more to be seen on the upside.
What's going on with gold and silver?
Those ones are biding their time here. You know, we take a look at it. We had just that big correction into February in both silver and gold. Gold had that 60% recovery rally. Silver was about 50%. Now we have been back down and tested those February lows again. This is very typical after you've had a big spike high. So for now, we are holding those February lows, trying to, you know, over the last, I would say, 5 or 6 days, put in a double bottom here. I think at the best, there's maybe an 4,800 would be a decent target for the gold market. We're sitting at 4,500 right now. Silver, same type of bounce is probably is possible there. But to build a base to take out the old highs, I think is far, far fetched. So, if you're trading the bullion or the stocks, don't be looking for too big a move. Just enjoy the small moves that might present themselves.
What's going on with copper?
Copper having trouble in here. It was a poor week this week. Closed off the week at 5:45, and there's a pretty big consolidation above us right now at the $5.80 to $6 range. And this is one that, like the other precious, like the other metals, is going to take time to base out. I think the level you need to look at is at 560. If it can manage to push through there, there's a possibility of something on the upside. The other markets, like uranium, has stabilized. We're looking at things like Cameco now at 104 Canadian. It's not broken as badly as other markets, and I think that this is in the potential level to create a base. And clearly, in the long run, this is the place you want to be.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Stable as far as the U.S. dollar is concerned, and not to be surprised. It's we're sitting at par against the basket, and as far as I can see, the bias here would be to the upside as long as it can hold 99, which was the corrective low that we saw in the last week or so. On the other side of the coin, the Canadian dollar just continues to have trouble, especially when you think about it relative to the what's going on in the crude oil market and what's also going on as far as the agricultural markets are concerned. So Canadian looking heavy, no reason to be long as far as I can see.
What's going on with Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is rolled over, pretty good resistance above us at this point. I thought it would hold in, but no, that's not the name of the game right now. We're at 66,000, good resistance at 70,000, and it looks like the easiest path on this one is back down under 60,000.
Anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
I think those were the big ones. The energies were the big one in the last few weeks, and they're not showing any signs of rolling over as of yet. So enjoy the run over there while it's on, and keep tight stops because eventually, these kind of markets do have bid corrections, and no point in riding it out.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
You're more than welcome, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Victor Adair, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in BC, but still very active in the markets. His website, victoradair.ca. He's speaking to us from beautiful Parksville on Vancouver Island. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Jim, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for having me on.
The last time we talked was just before the U.S. and Israel launched attacks on Iran, and obviously since then the war has had a huge impact on all the markets. Before we discuss individual markets, can you give us a snapshot of what has happened to different asset classes over the past 4 weeks?
Sure, I can do that. I think we probably have to start with crude oil prices. For anybody that hasn't been paying attention, they are up quite a bit. And when I say crude oil, it's, in a lot of ways, crude oil is fungible, depending on, who's going to refine it and all that sort of thing. But there's been quite a spread in the prices of different types of crude, and it kind of makes sense. For instance, WTI, which most of us know about, is sort of the North American, or one of the North American benchmarks. You know, it's up, it was trading about $55, I guess, in December. That was the low it's been for the past couple of years, and we're up just about $100 is where we are now on WTI. The benchmark for a lot of the world and certainly European market, Brent, it's trading about $112. That spread has widened out, and then various Mideast grades and markets in Asia are up substantially more than that. So that's been kind of the lead story, and I think the rising prices of crude have impacted everything, and it's not only the price, and maybe we'll get into this later, but the availability. In the United States, gasoline prices are up about 30% since the war began, and diesel prices are up about 45%. In more ways than one, it's a bifurcated market in terms of, are you, as a country, self-sufficient in oil or not? And if you're not, you should be concerned. And certainly those countries are. Their concern is, can we actually get the stuff? Whether the stuff means crude and they'll refine it themselves, or for countries like New Zealand, which has no refining capacity, or Australia, which has very little, they have to import refined products from different countries back in their neck of the woods there, primarily Japan, Korea, Singapore, Malaysia. If those countries decide they want to kind of keep what they got instead of giving it to anybody else, then certainly rationing will become an issue with the folks that are net importers. Stocks are down since the war started. I mean, we had the S&P make its all-time high in January, and it was starting to drift lower before the war started here at the beginning of March. But just to cut to the chase, the S&P is down about 8.5 from the highs in January. That would be a 7-month low. Going into the end of the week here, I think the markets, all of the stock markets, were closing at or near their lows. People are nervous about risk over the weekend when you can't get out of a trade. And it seems, that Trump likes to do things on a weekend when the markets are closed. He seems to be quite sensitive to the markets. So, yeah, the S&P down about 8%. The Dow down 5,500 points from the all-time highs it made. That's about a 10% drop in the Dow. You look at the Toronto market. Toronto, interestingly enough, made its all-time high on the first day of the war, March the 2nd. And I think you just relate that directly to the energy sector in the the Toronto stock market surged on the war news. But since then, Toronto has turned lower, as all the other markets in the world have, and down about 7%. U.S. dollar has been strong. It's risen against virtually all currencies here. You know, if your listeners have heard me say once, they've heard me say several times, capital comes to America for safety and opportunity. And this time, you know, it's safety maybe more than opportunity. The U.S. dollar was at a four-year low in January, right at the end of January, right about the same time when the gold market was making its all-time highs. So it's up about 4% from there. What else? Interest rates. I mean, interest rates are higher, I'd say, particularly on the short end as opposed to the long bonds, but everything's higher. The thinking there being that the higher energy costs are inflationary, and inflation is one of the things that the central banks are trying to fight, and the way they fight it would be with higher, you know, raising interest rates. And before I forget, the gold market, which you typically would think would be soaring on a war in the Middle East, and from the highs we had at the end of January to the lows we had this week or last week, it was about $5,500 from the highs, and dropped about $1,500. Let's say we're down about 25% on the gold price from the highs, and certainly, I mean, there's all kinds of stories out there, and, you know, the old saying about the first casualty of war is the truth, but you kind of have to believe, just by looking at the price action, there's been some liquidation, and it may be a case of central bank, Mid-Eastern countries that are used to a substantial cash flow from selling their oil. They're not getting that now. Maybe they're selling some gold, treasuries, whatever they can get their hands on, to raise cash, and certainly there's been some central banks selling into this rally in gold. So that's kind of a quick view of what's happened in the 4 weeks that the war has been on.
Crude oil prices have been sharply higher since the Iran war started at the beginning of March. What are the main issues driving the price higher, and what would be needed to get the prices lower again?
Yeah, I touched briefly on availability, and let's just round it out this way. Let's say the world consumes, on average, about 105 million barrels a day. And I think anybody that's been reading the newspapers and that knows that about 20% of the world's oil comes through the Straits of Hormuz. Now, not all of the oil, or I should say, not all of the amount of oil that used to come through there is blocked. There certainly has been oil coming out of the Middle East, not the least of which from the pipeline that the Saudis have from their east coast over to the west coast, the Red Sea. They're, I think, up to nearly 5 million barrels a day that they're pumping on that line. If they're not there yet, they're getting close. And their total exports previously were about 7. Without getting into too much detail, let's just say that the amount of oil coming out of the Mideast through the Straits of Hormuz is down 10%, thereabouts, from what it was before the war started. And in a market that is very much, you know, sort of just-in-time kind of supply chains, where everybody's just counting on their source of supply is going to be available, a 10% reduction boost prices as people are scrambling, you know, trying to outbid each other, as it were, to get oil. Before I forget, I should also mention natural gas is in there. Qatar has been substantially reduced in their ability to put LNG on ships. I'm gonna say they're not exporting any. It seems that way, but again, you never know. So what has caused the price to go up? It's been this worry that there's the current circumstances where there's some oil coming out of the Straits of Hormuz, and there's a worry that maybe there will be none, you know, depending on how the war goes. Then there is this scramble around the world between who's got adequate supplies, inventory, whatever you call it, or produce it themselves, and who's dependent upon getting product from other countries, which may decide, you know, on a whim or just out of, you know, I'm first, you're second. They don't want to reduce their inventory. So that's a consideration as well. And then, you know, there's war risk. There's whether or not you can get insurance on a ship to get it out. If you've got $100 million worth of oil on a ship, it's a pretty wild number. But I guess if you're carrying 2 million barrels and there's $100 oil, it's a hell of a lot of money. And if you can't get insurance, maybe you don't want to take your chances on losing that much money. Basically, the war is causing a lot of previous trafficking trade routes to be interrupted, and that's causing worries and concern about what may happen in the future if things get worse. The latter half of your question, what would need to happen to get the price lower again, I think you said? Ending the war would be good, cutting a deal of some kind so that the Strait of Hormuz traffic went back to what it was before, would be great. What does that involve? I mean, I've been paying such close attention here that certainly the past couple of weeks, there's so many conflicting opinions about what's going on and so on. I mean, at one point, Trump said the trade talks are going really well, and the Iranians, for their part, said, what trade talks? You know, so who do you believe? And Jim, it's just not going to work to try to go into, you know, share my half-baked thoughts on what might happen, you know, who's right, who's wrong, and all that. I'm just trying to view this strictly as a trader. And I think the market is just very hesitant to make any bets. I think the market does believe that Trump wants out. I think that is definitely in the market. It's whether or not he can get out on terms that are suitable to him. And certainly the allies, as it were, which would be the Americans and the Israelis working together, but also a lot of other people who have common interests in the Mideast there, are not all on the same page. So I don't know what will happen, but certainly what it would take to get prices back down again would be things that would lessen the people's worries about being able to get physical barrels.
Most of the leading global stock indices reached record highs earlier this year, but have fallen since the Iran war started. Why is that?
Well, let's see. I think there's a couple of thoughts to that. First of all, let's say that all of the stock markets were really extended. I mean, we were at all-time highs in January or February or whatever, and as the highs were sustained, it seemed to me that the riskier and riskier markets also ran higher. And, you know, the last couple of weeks before the beginning of March, one of the hottest markets in the world, one of the hottest stock indices in the world was Korea, and the market was just going nuts. There was an expression that the retail people in Korea, they were referred to as ants, and they would all be rushing and buying the same stock. The emerging markets, and this is markets, you know, not like the United States or Canada or Germany, but, you know, emerging markets. Maybe it's Ethiopia Stock Exchange or what have you. As my old friend Dennis Cox used to say, emerging markets are markets you cannot emerge from in an emergency. And, I mean, that was one of the hottest markets in the world. So that was the backdrop, okay? We had markets that were overextended. Even the really goofy stuff was getting aggressively bid higher. So in some ways, you know, the chartists in particular will say that's when you got to say, you know, we're cruising for a bruising here, and we're going to get a correction. Something will come along. Well, something came along. The war kind of got people to try to pull in their horns. And when the markets are overextended, people are probably using too much leverage, buying stuff that's more risky than they should be in, buying too much of it, whatever. So the market was ideally set up for a correction after having the great run that it had from April of last year, at reference to that as the Liberation Day break that we had on the market. The academics would tell you, and I think there's something to this, that the concerns about higher interest rates are never good news for stock markets, especially when they're overextended like that. And then prospects of much slower economies ahead because of maybe the shortage of crude oil, or maybe higher prices for crude oil and products, or maybe both of those things. And, you know, then your multiples on price earnings ratios and so on gets reduced. And then once the selling starts, people that were out over their skis, they have to start selling too because prices are going down, and then you get a bit of a steamrolling effect. So that's probably a little too simple. It wouldn't be economics 101, but, you know, I'm a trader, and that's the way I look at things, and I think those are some of the reasons the stock market has come off. And certainly, you know, I mean, it seems the last couple of weeks, and again this week, the market's like closing right on its lows, because nobody, and that's a euphemism, but really nobody wants to take more risk into the weekend than they should, because if something happens over the weekend, you can't get out. So we got selling into the Friday.
The U.S. dollar has risen again against nearly all the currencies in March. Is that mainly because the U.S. produces all the oil and gas it needs and is also a net exporter of oil and gas?
You know, there's definitely some of that. I was mentioning earlier about the bifurcated nature of things here. Either a country has enough or they don't. And the United States has got way more than they need, let's say that, and the ability to deal with it, you know, refine it and so on and so on. So, in a way, they're sitting pretty. By the way, as are the Russians. The Russians are doing great. This is a wonderful thing for the Russians. I saw the Financial Times here earlier this week was estimating that the Russians were making an extra $150 million a day, or a week. Sorry, it's been a long week. One of the two. But the Russians were making a hell of a lot more money than they were before, you know, when the price was 50 or 60 bucks on WTI, and they were selling their stuff at a discount to that. So, yeah, there's some of that, but then there's also this thing of, you know, capital comes to America for safety and opportunity. That's important. And the capital, by the way, doesn't have to be foreign money coming into the States. Maybe Americans have invested outside the States, you know, the people going into emerging markets and that, or, you know, they think, hey, we've done really well in the States. All these other markets are going to play catch up. Let's move out there. So some of that money may be coming back. But, yeah, capital flows one of the first things capital is looking for is safety. And then, you know, you decide how much risk you want. If really safety is just flashing red lights to you, then when you look around the world, you go to the United States, maybe you go to Switzerland. Interestingly enough, Switzerland was at like all-time highs, and it's actually down a bit against the U.S. dollar since the war started here, which I think goes to my point about capital. When things get serious, the United States dollar, or being invested, having your money, you know, in a bank, in a savings account in Kansas, is better than having your money someplace else in some other spot in the world. So I think it's more of that, but certainly America being self-sufficient in energy the way they are, being removed from, you know, safely far enough away from missiles and all that kind of thing, I think that's more important. And then, as I mentioned at the top, the U.S. dollar was at a four-year low, and the market was positioned, when I look at how speculators were positioned, they were heavily short the U.S. dollar, particularly against the euro. So as things turned, then those guys have to reverse their positions as well, and that helped drive the U.S. dollar higher.
Canada is self-sufficient in oil and gas and is a net exporter like the U.S. Why is the Canadian dollar weakening?
Okay, fair enough, and you're right. Canada did go bid when the war first started. And on one of the interviews I did that first week or so, I said, you know, the Canadian dollar is up. It's a petrol currency. And somewhere, Justin Trudeau is crying about that. Canada did make a run higher the first 10 days or so after the war started. But since then, I think it's been pulled lower. It's down about 2 cents from its highs. Let's say we were at 74.5 and now we're at 72.5, something like that. As all of the other currencies were weakening against the U.S. dollar. Now here's, I've traded currencies for years, decades actually, and one of the things I've noticed about the Canadian dollar over the years, that most of the time when it changes value against the U.S. dollar, it doesn't have anything to do with what's going on in Canada. Okay? In other words, it's not a Canadian specific thing that has happened that causes the Canada to move. Canada, more often than not, just follows the euro and the British pound and the yen around. Now, over big sweeps of time, over the past 25 years or so, Canada is correlated broadly with ups and downs in the commodity market. You might remember the Canadian dollar hit an all-time high in 2007. Yes, it went up to $1.10 briefly. Hard to imagine when it's here at 72 cents. And then again in 2011, when there was that mini commodity boom after the great financial crisis, the Canadian dollar traded up to about $1.05. So Canada certainly has that correlation with commodities. Canada, yes, you're right. We are self-sufficient. We're a net exporter. You know, why isn't the Canadian dollar doing better? The Bank of Canada, by the way, the forward markets, you know, a month ago, 6 weeks ago, were expecting likely another cut from the Bank of Canada. Now the forwards are pricing the chances are, that the Bank of Canada, if, I guess, inflation worries stay where they are, Bank of Canada will be raising interest rates. Sorry to just kind of go on here, but I think really the weakness in Canada the last 2 weeks has been not anything specific to do with Canada. It's just been the Canadian dollar following the other major currencies and being in an environment where everybody says, I don't care what it is, I just want to switch into the U.S. dollar.
You're saying interest rates have gone up since the Iran war started. I can understand that higher energy prices may cause higher inflation, but won't higher energy prices also slow the economy, which would mean central banks should be cutting interest rates?
Well, yeah, that is, you're absolutely right. That's a good conundrum. And I can see that. What I look at really is what the market is doing. Now, sometimes I'll think it should be doing something else, and then another part, the risk management part of me goes, well, yeah, but that doesn't matter because it's doing what it's doing. There were, say, about a dozen of the key central banks all had scheduled meetings last week. And all of them, from, you know, the Bank of Japan to Switzerland to England to the ECB to the USA to Canada, all of the spokesmen for the central banks were expressing their concern that this sharp increase in energy costs was going to feed through, as it were, to higher inflation. And I think nobody actually used the word transitory, but, you know, you could kind of hear it going around in the back of their minds that they were hoping that this would just be transitory, and so therefore they weren't going to do anything right now because, you know, that would be foolish. We've got to wait and see how this plays out. But they were trying to be fair with the market, saying, you know, if inflation goes up substantially higher than where we want it to be, then we will be raising interest rates. The bond market fell sharply starting on the second day of March. Yields went higher, prices went lower. Not as dramatically as the short end, and I think that was more a reflection of what you were just talking about. Gee, you know, higher energy prices could slow the economy. That means you think the central bank would more likely be cutting in an environment like that. Slowing economy means unemployment is rising, that kind of thing. So maybe that's why the back end didn't react as dramatically as the front end. That's what's happened. Interest rates have gone up. I would say if the market gets a view that the energy markets are going to, the prices of the energy markets are going to stay high, then we'll probably be talking more and more likely the central banks are going to start to boost short rates.
Gold prices have fallen over $1,000 since the Iran war started. It seems counterintuitive. Why has it been happening?
Yeah, I guess I mentioned briefly at the top there when you asked me about the markets, gold, and you're 100% right. That is just so counterintuitive that gold, after everything I've been through trading gold for 50 years, if you would have told me some time ago that the price of gold would fall 25% when there was a major war in the Middle East, I just would not be able to put two and two together and have that make any sense. But then let's go, like I did with the stock market, let's go to where gold was before this happened. We made all-time highs in gold at the end of January, and on the front month futures in the COMEX in New York, that was about $5,500. Gold, and we've talked about this before, but the gold shares had just totally outperformed gold for the past 12 months. And why shouldn't they? Because gold shares, at a very simple way of looking at them, are a levered bet on gold. You know, unless the gold mining company's operating costs are also soaring, which they weren't, then their profit margins are just going to go nuts, crazy wide, if the gold price is going up, but their operating costs haven't. So that's what I mean by a levered bet on gold. So we had gold there at all-time highs at the end of January, and of course, I mean, how could you ignore silver? Silver had just gone nuts ballistic to the upside. And I would say my view at that time was the market was really in the thrall of speculative excesses. And, you know, and I, believe me, I've trafficked in the physical gold market. You know, I understand people that really think gold is the epicenter of the financial world. I get it. But even that, and you know, I think you just have to look at silver, can be subject to speculative excesses. You know, you look at the late night ads on TV about some guy pushing gold as, you know, the right thing to do. You know, call us and we'll sell it to you at a huge markup. Whatever. We were, I think, excessively, speculatively overbought at the end of January, and just like the stock market was around the same time or a little later, was vulnerable to a correction. And one of the things about gold is, you know, you can always sell gold. If the things are, you know, if the financial markets are in tough shape and you can't get out of your stocks or you don't want to because the people that are bidding for them are just offering you a pittance, you know, you can sell gold. When you really need liquidity, that's what gold's all about. Well, I think there has been, clearly there's been selling of gold. It's dropped 25%. You know, who was doing it? Certainly there was, I think the Central Bank of Turkey did report that they did sell. There's probably been other central bank selling or sovereign wealth selling or whatever. But anyway, a market that was speculatively overbought set up a condition for the market to start to sell. There were a lot of people in that market that were probably over-leveraged, just like the case in the stock market. It was interesting that the S&P and gold both peaked out virtually at the same time. So, yeah, over-leveraged, and the market started to fall, and when that happens, then people who are over-leveraged, they have to sell as well, and we came down. It doesn't make sense in an academic way that gold would fall when there's a war in the Middle East, but you know, that then puts people in a position, and this is where it gets tricky. I can't tell you how many times in my life I've heard some version of this when I was working as a commodity broker. A guy would have a position on, it'd be going against him, and he'd say, let's give it a couple more days. I just know this market's going to turn around. Okay, and when you are in a market and you're wrong and you're over-levered and you're saying that, believe me, you're going to lose money. So, and there had to be some of that. People just couldn't believe the gold was going down, so they hung on until they had to sell, or their margin clerks blew them out.
The war has overshadowed the problems in private credit. What are your thoughts about that?
I'll put it this way. My thoughts are that if we weren't having a war in Iran, private credit worries would be the headline on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. I mean, it's a big deal, but and it's not like it's going unnoticed. Certainly, people, it's being noticed, but you know, they don't talk about it on the evening news like they talk about the war in Iran. That's for sure. Private credit. Well, here's a couple of things. Okay, you put money into a private deal, and the reason you do that is because the yields appear to be, or you're told they're going to be, substantially higher than if you just put your money into a money market fund that was in T-bills and whatnot. Okay, and now the give up is that you can't get out, just like you can. If you got T-bills, you can sell T-bills in a heartbeat. You know, they've got, that's liquidity. But the private equity guys, it's not. And one of the reasons, and it's not like they're trying to trick anybody, but they're taking money and they're putting it into investments, typically, that, you know, aren't liquid themselves. Let's say you're, for instance, you're buying an airport in Australia. Your payout, you've got the spreadsheets mapped out for the next 20 years. You've got to put a lot of capital up front, some of it's equity, some of it's credit, debt, I should say. And, you can't just, you know, sell a runway or whatever. So there's that. So that's why they would, all of these private equity deals have some sort of a caveat, and I shouldn't say all of them, but mostly. They're going to say, okay, we recognize that some people are going to need, you know, the money, whatever. You know, you had a problem and you need cash, and so you want to liquidate your investment. So first of all, you probably got to give them a month or 2 months notice, and then they will limit the amount of aggregate redemptions to maybe 5% of their total capital or something like that. Or some of them will just say, no, we're just going to gate the fund and you can't get your money back. Anyway, that's kind of the conundrum. You've got people that have put money into a deal because they're going to get substantially more, or they believe they're going to get substantially more yield than if they put it in T-bills. And they have to give up liquidity for that, and they understand that going in, or if they don't, then they're really not paying attention. And then they find themselves in a spot where, ooh, they want out. Now, why would they want out? Either they've got a problem specific to them that they need cash for, or, and this is more likely the case, they're looking around and they're hearing, hey, these deals are, they're going sour. And some of the people that were running the deals have been bullshitting about what the value of the security really was. They call it what they market to. And so then they say, hey, you know, we got some money in that private fund. Let's phone them up and get out of there. And so as that starts to happen, then more people want to get out. You know, that's the herd effect. So that's been what's been going on, and it's a problem. And as I say, if it wasn't for the war, it would probably be front page news in the Wall Street Journal.
Before we wrap up, would you like to talk about how or what you've been trading since the war started?
Yeah, I could do that. One of the things I put in my blog either this past week or 2 weeks ago, it was a very simple equation, and that is vol up, size down. Hmm. And that is, that's like lesson number two or three in the risk management book of things you need to do. When the market gets crazy volatility, and I'll tell you, I saw just implied volatility on the front month's crude oil options. I saw it running at around 180%. And I don't know if I've ever seen anything at 180%. It was just unbelievable. I think that worked out to at 180%, and you know, there's some option geeks out there will laugh when I say this, but I think that works out to the market's pricing about a 10% per day change in the price. So if you're going to participate in a market, like try to trade those options with that kind of volatility, you better reduce your size. clearly. You know, if you're normally going to be trading 10 cars or 100 cars or whatever it is, you should probably be trading one, you know, or five or something, because you're just taking on a ton more risk. So vol up, size down. So I've definitely, with the trading I'm doing, one of my clients used to refer to me as the little old lady from Chicago. And actually, I kind of took that as a compliment. Yeah, I'm not a wild and crazy guy. My number one job as a trader is to protect my capital. And it's not the you got a hunch, bet a bunch school of trading. I do not subscribe to that. So you're asking me how and what I've been doing. So that's the how. I've been doing very small, really reduced size. I have had some good fortune here over the past 3 weeks or so. As the bond market sold off hard, the volatility in bonds also rose, and I was selling some puts in bonds, sort of with the view that, you know, if the thing trades through my strike price and then I've got the premium for cushion beyond that, you know, I might just say, okay, yeah, I'm happy to be long the bonds at that level. That would be, you know, kind of the first question I'd ask myself before I would start shorting puts. And then it's, again, how many do you want to sell? Vol's up, that's great. And theta is really working my favor. I'm selling short-dated puts 10 days, 2 weeks out, that side, kind of thing. So the clock is really working in my favor. And I'm taking an amount of risk that I'm comfortable with. I did some trading both on the long side and the short side, trading S&Ps over here the past couple of weeks. I'm not absolutely sure, but I think, in fact, I'm quite sure I was a net loser doing that. It was just, the market was so choppy, and I thought, I'll just kind of sit on the sidelines. And I have to wrap this up with quoting an old friend of mine, Peter Appleby, who died last fall, where Peter would say, you know, when people are thinking, God, I'm missing a trade, I got to get in, I got to do something, he'd say, you know, there's a rumor going around. The markets are going to be open again next week. And that's kind of the way I look at it. Yeah, I've done some trading. I've net made money here over the past couple of weeks. It's not been a fortune, but, you know, I'm covering my expenses and so on. And I'm going into the weekend flat. I don't have anything on because there's a lot of weekend risk. And the markets will be open again next week. And there will be some opportunities that if I like the risk profile on them, I'll get involved.
Victor, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jimmy, as I say, it's always fun to talk with you and have a good ramble. Thank you.
My guest has been Victor Adair, his website victoradair.ca. He was speaking to us from Parksville on Vancouver Island. Coming up, the Aiden sisters, Marianne and Pamela, next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guests are the Aiden sisters, Marianne and Pamela, founders of the Aiden Forecast online at AidenForecast.com. They're speaking to us from Costa Rica. Marianne and Pam, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Well, thank you for having us.
Can you tell us about the Aiden Forecast and how our listeners can subscribe to it?
Well, we've been writing the Aiden Forecast for 45 years now, a monthly letter with weekly updates, and we have a special if they'd like for your listeners, and if they go to info@aidenforecast.com, we'll be happy to set it up in a special offer.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we find in the Aiden Forecast?
Well, we cover the major markets, so the stock market, the precious metals, and the resource sector, energy, interest rates. Currencies. We go through the whole thing, and also how they move opposite or together. And we look at the macro trends. That's important. The focus and on the intermediate moves are also important. Meaning moves that could last 6 months, or so on an intermediate basis is always things we focus on. And the idea is buying in the low when the major trends are heading up, and so during a high-ish time period. So trying to get the best middle, that's kind of been always our focus on the markets. And also the global economy, of course. We follow the economies the same, so because they all fit in. What's happening in the world economy or in the U.S. economy, or we focus on that and how it applies to the markets as well.
The Iran war and shortages of crude oil, natural gas, and fertilizers, what are you hearing? And is President Trump likely to make a deal to get peace in the Middle East?
I don't think it's going to be easy to get peace now after what's happened so far. And but thinking of peace in the Middle East would be now, I think it's something, a wishful thinking. Hopefully it would happen, but it's not likely. There's been a lot of damage done already, and the shortages are horrible. It's the worst in decades, and it's a global problem. It's not just a U.S. Iranian problem. It's a global problem that the shortages of oil, natural gas, fertilizers, like it's really going to hurt the global economy if this continues. So then we're watching it closely, of course, like everyone else. It has been putting pressure on, clearly on the stock market and the bond market, and even the precious metals and resources. It's pretty much put a damper on all of them.
After spiking, crude oil has pulled back a bit, then Brent went for a run. Do you think we're in for more volatility in the oil markets and possibly higher highs ahead?
Yes, we do. We think oil has been very much volatile due to what's happening in the Middle East. And since it doesn't look like that's going to be coming to an end real soon, hopefully it will, but as long as it continues, it's going to keep upward pressure on oil. And unfortunately, we think it has a lot of upside still to go as far as how high it could go. Its record high was at 150, and it's increasingly looking like it may be about to repeat that performance, especially if the situation in Iran intensifies.
But also what's interesting about oil is when we compare it to like copper or any some of the resources that have already started taking off, especially with looking at the precious metals, and what has risen due to war reasons is actually just in just price movement, it's catching up to the rise that's already happened. It's been a few years in, say, the copper market and a lot of the base metals. So that we thought that was very interesting that it's caught up to that because it was so unusually low. So we don't know if that means we'll have higher highs, even if there is some kind of peace in the Middle East. But it's interesting that because also we follow uranium, which is the clean energy, and that's been a great investment for people, and it will continue to be. So we're keeping a close eye on oil for other reasons as well.
With shortages of oil and natural gas, along with the growth in electric vehicles and AI, could the battery metals sector heat up?
Well, yes, definitely. There's already, China controls the critical minerals market for decades, and the West is now catching up to realizing how important they are for AI and for the materials, the essentials for AI, tech, defense, energy, all of that, and that's including the batteries for EVs and all that. It looks like we're going to have a major, it's already started really, like a big rise like in copper, cobalt, lithium, rare earth, and many more of those critical materials that are in there. We think we're in for a big rise on that in those sectors.
Gold had a great run and has since pulled back. Where do you see gold going?
Gold is very interesting because it's really, like last year, for example, it rose 64%. And it's been very bullish. We're still very bullish on gold. And now that it has come down a bit, it's only really come down, even though it hasn't reacted like everyone was kind of expecting that with the Middle East intensifying, gold would move up. but we think it will eventually, and it's probably already started. It basically had a 19% correction, which isn't all that unusual during a bull market. And so we see it continuing to rise this year, and we're very bullish on gold. And our upside forecast, and this is just based on if gold just repeats what it has done in previous bull markets, exactly percentage-wise, it could rise still to the $7,000 or $8,000 level in this bull market.
Silver had a great move to over $120 U.S. and then a significant pullback. What do you see ahead for silver?
Yeah, silver sure has been, it's always been more volatile than gold. It rises more and it falls more. But in the end, the percentage gains, you'll get more in silver than you will in gold, although they're both great. But yes, it's already come down 40%, which sounds like a lot just since this year. But it's risen well over 200% already, and just looking at the past year. So, I mean, that's showing how wild, much more wild it is than gold. But no, we see a lot more upside on silver. We think it could eventually get maybe closer to 150. And maybe 170, but right in that level. And we're looking at for this weakness that we're in now, once it can break back above the 7980 level, we think a renewed rise will be well underway. So, we like silver just like we like gold. We think that the bull market is not over yet, and this is this weakness is providing a good buying area for people who want to buy new positions. Yes.
Copper is showing strength. Is this a good sign for the economy?
Well, it's interesting because normally a strong copper price, which we have a very steady rise in copper over the last few years, and it just has much more room to go on the upside. And normally they would call it Dr. Copper because it would tell us about the economy. But now it seems like it's a bit different because copper is needed in so many more areas than your usual traditional industrial manufacturing while the economy is strong. So this is to see if it's just a sector strength like AI needs, just like I was saying, like the clean energy. And like a lot of things are needed for copper now compared to 10 years ago even. And so we'll see if it's going to reflect a strong economy. It's not like a done deal like it used to be, but it might be an influence.
I just wanted to add that there's other factors overpowering copper strength and that will affect the economy more than just copper rising. So this is something that, like Pam said, it's not like it used to be. Before, copper was always a sign of a strong economy, and we basically don't think so this time around.
Could the big moves in the price of metals be ushering in years of good markets for the miners?
Oh, yes. Very good. Yeah, we really enjoy the gold and silver shares and even some platinum shares, and they've been excellent. The last several years, since 2022, it's actually 2015, but 2022 is when the market really started taking off more strongly, and it's just been a nonstop over the last few years. So this downtime is just a nice breather time, actually, for the metals and a good time to get in. But yes, we like the miners, too. We've been mainly in the seniors, but there's some good juniors as well.
Yes. Also, comparing all of the precious and the base metals, the shares were the strongest last year, outperforming all of the other markets.
The U.S. dollar's been showing strength since late January. Where do you see the greenback going from here?
Yeah, isn't that crazy? One would never expect that after hitting four-year low. It's been rising with the war, pretty much, and it's because people are looking for liquidity and looking for fast cash, and they're going to the dollar. So This tension and war has been keeping the dollar up, and today it reached a little high for this rise.
Bitcoin, people are saying it's a tool for money laundering. What have you heard, and what do you see ahead for Bitcoin?
Well, we like Bitcoin. Bitcoin is like the other markets. It's been correcting downward, and We feel it's becoming more mainstream for sure, and we see it as a good option. Right now, it may go a little bit lower, but we think eventually, like the metals, it will continue to rise and head much higher in, say, looking out to the end of the year, the months ahead. And so we do like Bitcoin.
President Trump has predicted on more than one occasion that the Dow will see 100,000 by the end of his term. That would have to double in less than 3 years. Any thoughts on how we could see a 100,000 Dow?
No, we don't think so. We think, on the contrary, the stock market is starting to show significant signs of weakness that we're watching very closely at this moment, because the market had been looking tired, but now it's starting to break down, primarily because of Iran, but there's a lot of other reasons too. And we're not so bullish on at all on the stock market, and that goes for all of the global markets. They all generally move together, and they're all under downward pressure right now.
With the war and supply shortages in the Middle East, are we likely to see higher interest rates ahead?
Yes. We think that even without the war, before even the war broke out, we were thinking higher rates for longer. It was as what we see. Not necessarily this year. Maybe the rates have come down a bit, and they could still maybe come down, although with the inflation the way it is and how the war is developing, it's going to be hard for rates to go down, maybe stay unchanged for a while, and maybe go down a bit more this year. But we see higher for longer, definitely, interest rates. They're on the way up, and they're already hitting new 6 to 8 month highs in this week. Like, that's just the beginning. This looks like that's where the interest rates are going to go higher.
And again, that's globally, too.
Yes.
Is debt the elephant in the room?
Definitely. It's definitely the elephant in the room, and not only in the U.S., but global debt is at $350 trillion, which is way more than is even understandable as far as in relation to GDP of all the countries. So we have a situation that's totally unsustainable. And so this is very important, and it's pretty much the foundation of what's moving most of the markets as well, is the debt situation and the fact that they're not going to be able to pay it off. So in other words, that more money is printed, created in different ways, either by more bonds being available or just outright adding money to the system, kind of QE style. And this will all be very inflationary in the end as far as the world economies go. And then that in turn is going to be bullish for gold.
President Trump keeps talking about Canada becoming the 51st state. Would it be good for Canada, and do you think it'll happen?
No, we think strongly it will not happen. In fact, it's an insult to the Canadians to even say that. And that's how we feel. Like, there's no way it would become the 51st state. They are, we've talked to a lot of Canadians about it, and you probably would agree you would like to keep your own country the way it is. But anyway, no, we don't think it'll happen.
What sectors do you like going forward?
Well, we like the resources. We like the precious metals, mainly gold and silver, and their shares, specific shares that we like. And the resource sector, we think, even could have eventually a higher rise and a bigger bull market going forward into later this year into this next year. On what we had mentioned about how much they're in demand, they're in great demand. So, in fact, there's a lot more demand than supply. So, everyone has to see it. Like, we strongly recommend buy and hold on those sectors.
Over the years, you've gained wisdom that made you better speculators?
Definitely, yes. You go gaining wisdom as you move along. You have a lot of experience. We've seen a lot of these cycles repeat. And It's very interesting, actually. It's pretty fascinating because sometimes we'll see something in a market. For example, I can just tell you gold, for example. We knew it was going to be going up strongly. We didn't know what might trigger it. And now we're seeing some of these factors coming forward that are triggering it. So those kind of things become more apparent with the more experience you have. So we still enjoy what we do after all these years, and we look forward to it. It makes it very interesting. And in fact, one person we follow who we admire very much is Ray Dalio, and he follows a 500-year cycle. And we find that very interesting. We've been following that as well. And it shows that right now is a time that has repeated over the years, like every 7,500 years, that it's a time of crisis, chaos, uncertainty, and it's all happening again. So these are things that you know, history never repeats exactly the same way, but it does repeat, and it's fun. Fun for us. To kind of like a puzzle, and it's very fascinating and profitable as well.
Is the key to a happy life finding a job that you enjoy?
I
definitely
think so.
Yeah, because then it's not a job anymore, it's just fun, it's something you enjoy. So yeah, that would be like the maximum for anyone starting out, and look, whatever you like, go that way, and or what you feel you like the most in life. I could just start doing something in that line, because that's what we did by accident, and actually, but it ended up being that we just enjoy it. Like, and people say, aren't you going to retire? We go, retire? We already kind of are, but it's just a very enjoyable time to always be watching all the different moving parts in this world.
Well, I always think if somebody enjoys their job, movie actors who make $25 million a movie, even if they weren't doing that, they probably would be doing local community theater. Musicians that pack stadiums, they've told me, even if we weren't doing this, every Saturday night we would be in somebody's basement playing in front of 12 people. They just enjoy it that much.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that's right. And as you get older, you actually appreciate things a lot more, and you can reflect a lot more.
What do you think has been the secret to your success?
Well, we're consistent. We're very strict with ourselves on what our beliefs are in the market. Like, we always talk it out. We aren't bullheaded by all means. But when we see a bull market, it's a bull market till it's over. And
I think so. You have to be flexible, and if you're wrong, it's, you know, you can't have a big ego. You have to be quick to say, okay, this didn't work out, and get out, and then let the profits run on the ones that are where you have go accumulating a good track record over the long haul, because you just let the market tell you what to do rather than the other way around. So a lot of people in this business, try to think that their way of thinking is the right way, and nothing else can change that. Where, I mean, we obviously have our opinions, but if we see they're not working out for some reason, we'll be quick to change course.
Yeah, patience is very important in this business.
Yes.
So sometimes you just have to wait and be like the tiger waiting for the attack, but you just wait for the right moment, and that takes patience. And we have learned patience with the markets.
Any last-minute advice you'd like to give people about the situation we're seeing right now?
Well, we think everyone should be aware that we're in a very unusual, unprecedented situation. Keep an eye on it, and watch your money closely, and be invest accordingly. Like right now, a lot of people have moved into cash, and that's not a bad thing. We, of course, think precious metals are even 10 times better, but it just depends on the person. We'd be cautious on the stock market if they're in stocks, which most people are, or a lot of them are, and realize that it's been a long time since there's been a bear market, but we keep seeing signals that one may be coming up right ahead. So we'd be very cautious with stocks.
Yeah, like it's interesting that the Magnificent Seven, as they're called, like Google and Meta and Microsoft, so the seven, Amazon, they have, since last October as a whole, they have been looking like a toppy and sideways market while some of the industrials started becoming stronger and thinking maybe there's a change in the market itself. But in the end, it wasn't. It's just now with NASDAQ hitting another low today, it's really they're all on the verge of turning into a real bear market instead of just a downward correction. They're getting very close to that. And it's interesting that with AI and the way that it's been changing right now and the way that they're seeing the reality of the demand that they need for it to continue growing, the AI, they're looking for consolidation. They're looking at different things. There's more pressure on them now with social media hurting the young. And so now there's more things that are hitting their reality. And so the Magnificent Seven aren't so magnificent anymore.
No, it's true.
I'm sure they'll be fine in the future. But for right now, the market is not the place you want to be. The markets hate higher interest rates, and it hates wars. Anything that makes you uncertain as an investor is bad for the stock market especially.
How can our listeners follow you and subscribe to the Aiden Forecast?
Oh, well, thank you. That's a very nice thing. But we can offer a special so they can give us a try for a couple of months. And we'd be happy to give them, say, $29 for 2 months to give us, see how they like it. That would get two issues and eight weekly updates. And just write a note to info@aidenforecast.com. And they'll be happy to set you up.
And mention that they came from your interview.
Yes, because that's a special offer. Mm. So just say from this interview, and right away you get the special.
Excellent. Marianne and Pamela, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
My guests have been the Aiden sisters, Marianne and Pamela, founders of the Aiden Forecast online at aidenforecast.com. They were speaking to us from Costa Rica. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Victor Adair, and Marianne and Pamela Aiden. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.